Okay. Okay, so here we go. I usually start with Namo Tassa, because it's Buddha's teachings. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa. Very good. Now, as you know, this is will be, as far as I know, the last sutta class before we start the rains retreat. And during the rains retreat, so there will be no sutta classes from here for 3 months. So the last three sutta classes which I've done here, I never really expected to do them. I expected Ajahn Brahmani to be here for those, but it wasn't to be. So I chose some suttas quite quickly, but they're some of my favorite suttas. And last fortnight ago was the Upakalesa Sutta, which was emphasizing the importance of nimittas and how you deal with the problems with those nimittas, which happened at the deep stage of meditation when the body is just about turned off and the nimittas, the sign of the mind, starts to manifest. But today is another of my favorite suttas, and this time though, you may notice later on that I have slightly reformatted. I'm just too respectful of the Buddha to, change anything. But I have taken out a couple of repetitions. I'll let you know when those repetitions have been taken out. It makes it easier to understand. And number two, put in sort of like a list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Please, it's not adding anything, it's just making it easy for people to understand when they read these suttas without changing them. So this is called the Exposition of Non-Conflict. And just a little summary before I begin, that this Exposition of Non-Conflict, it has a number of very powerful statements in there. And one is about the sorts of pleasures to be followed and those to be avoided. And also that you'll see here that in some of the descriptions of the pleasures not to be avoided, the Buddha doesn't mince his words. In the translations, they soften it up so it can get past censors and stuff. But I'm going to actually say, what the word in Pali is and what its usual meaning is. And that's something to look forward to in a few moments. And also, one of the other things I really love about this is how when you praise or disparage something, you try never to praise a person or disparage a person or a group of people. You just what's called teaching the Dhamma. And you'll find out what that means in a few moments. And also about they have two categories here, covert speech and overt speech. The covert speech is what you hear in private, almost like in secret. Have you heard what Ajahn So that's covert. He's actually in quarantine for another day because he went to Sydney. So that's another secret speech. Another thing is overt speech, what everybody knows. So, and they, when it comes to overt speech, I'll also make a little comment there how for Buddhist monks, we're always supposed to use the overt speech, especially if there's any criticism or anything to do. To actually to do it literally means to your face. In other words, you don't hide it. Because we always find that the hide it in secrecy. But somehow I think there is some covert, some secret stuff going on for my birthday, isn't there, Prem? Some covert stuff? Secret stuff. But I know most about that. So anyway, and lastly, the point six, not insist on local language, not insist on local language, and we should not override normal usage. And this is one of many statements which the Buddha made throughout the suttas. The point of the Dhamma is so that people can understand it. So you use language in the local style, if possible, so people can really understand what these words actually mean. So there's so many points in this. I really love this sutta. It's one of my favorites. So here we go. This is the exposition on non-conflict, the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. And it's number 139 of the middle length sayings. Here we go. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Buddha was living at Sawati in Jeta's Grove, the Jetavana, Anathapindika's Park. And those who've been on pilgrimage, you know that place, it's still there. Only now monks have to pay to go in there. I was always a bit upset about that, I don't know why, because it's the national heritage or whatever of India. And so they insisted if you go with a tourist group, they have to pay for you as well. Anyway, there the Buddha, Anathapindika's Park. There the Buddha addressed the Sangha thus, Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Buddha said this, Bhikkhus, I shall teach you an exposition of non-conflict. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhus replied. And now, in a small version, you can't see the 6 points here. Number one, the Buddha said this. One should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And one should not pursue asceticism, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The middle way discovered by the Buddha avoids both extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, that's upasama, to direct knowledge, abhinya, to enlightenment, sambodhi, and to nibbana. Now, first of all, you've heard that before because that's one of the first teachings of the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths. And before the Four Noble Truths, about the middle way, sorry. And interestingly, the word here for low is like hina. It's the same word which is sometimes used for Theravada, hina-yana. And it's actually quite offensive. The word vulgar gamma does mean of the village. Coarse is potujanika, the putujana, which is like of people not enlightened. Ignoble and arya, unbeneficial, one should not pursue. Ignoble and unbeneficial. And number two, one should not pursue asceticism, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Instead of saying the usual word, self-mortification, that was just so extreme. It's just asceticism. It literally means atta gilamatanu yoga, things which wear you out, tire you. From the word kilam, words which lead to tiredness, exhaustion. That's what the word means, and this is an important part. Not ascetic, and also not indulging in sensory pleasures. Instead, one follows the middle way. This is just the introduction, and these are explained in detail afterwards. One should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage, and knowing both, extolling and disparaging, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. That'll be explained in a few minutes. One should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. And that is, when you first read that is actually quite a powerful statement. especially for some religions which think, oh no, no, avoid pleasure at all costs. This is the inward pleasure path. And one should not utter covert speech, one should not utter overt sharp speech. One should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. And one, lastly, one should not insist on local language, and one should not override normal usage. This is the summary of the exposition of non-conflict. So now you see, as you scroll down, so it should be a number one there somewhere. On the top, oh yeah, it's right on the bottom of the page there. So having said those six, almost like chapter descriptions, now we go into each one in detail. Number one, one should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and one should not pursue asceticism, which is painfully noble and unbeneficial. So it was said, and with reference to what was it said? The pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desires, low, coarse, vulgar, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of the enjoyment of one whose pleasure is linked to sensual desire is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way. The pursuit of asceticism, painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of asceticism, painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, and despair, and fever. It is the right way. Okay, please excuse me there, but I thought I deleted some of those repetitions. When it says in each one of these is a state with suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, it's the right way, or the opposite, it's the wrong way. I only wanted to put that in there once, but somehow or other it's got its way back in there again. I do apologize, but the pursuit of perfection when you use a computer is a state which leads to vexation and suffering. And you know that, and I know that right now as well. So with reference to this, that it was said, one should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial, and one should not pursue asceticism, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The middle way discovered by the Buddha avoids both these extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right motivation, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right renunciation, right mindfulness, and right stillness. So it was reference to this that it was said, the middle way discovered by the Buddha avoids both these extremes and leads to nibbana. So you may recognize that when we have the description of the Eightfold Path, you see that I do love to adjust some of those old translations from Pali into English. And you see the right view, I always liked that translation. But where many people put right thought for the second part of the Eightfold Path and Asama Sankhapa, I always rejected that from the early years of my monastic life. It was always a deep question, thinking, is there such a thing as right thought? And especially later on in some of the deep teachings of the Buddha in the suttas, you see that thought is always conditioned so much that often you cannot trust it. So instead of right thought, and you look deeper into that explanation by the Buddha, Sammasankhapa, it became quite clear, it's nothing to do with thought. Many times people said intentions, but even intentions, it's not what you're aiming for. It's where you're coming from. And that has a word in Pali called motivation. And it was, you know, from the time I learnt Pali, in order to understand the Vinaya, the rules for the monks and for the nuns, that I made a, you know, a very clear distinction there, which I thought was obvious from the suttas, of motivation, intention. Motivation is where you're coming from. Intention is where you're going to. And if there's any lawyers here, you know that is part of Western law as well. You know, where do you intend to go with this? Or why did you do it? Where's it coming from? And those two are sometimes confused, but I found that it's very important to know the difference. And here it's like where you're coming from, the motivation. And that also makes it very clear, as the Buddha said, the Sammasankappa, the three right motivations. It's coming from letting go, renunciation, coming from loving kindness, avayapada, and coming from ahimsaka, gentleness. That was so important for me because this is Eightfold Path, this is how you're supposed to practice. So anything which was too harsh, that's part of asceticism. This is kindness, gentleness, and renunciation, letting go. Powerful. And then also the right speech, action, and livelihood. This is what you do. Before it's where you come from. And then what is usually called the right effort. And of course, you've heard me so many times, you know, bridling against that. Something is wrong with that. Because, you know, in deep meditation, it's effortless. And many times you've heard me teach in meditation, you just let go. You've heard so many years people reminding me of the simile of the driverless bus, which I did. Apparently that was about, oh, I remember now, that was 30 years ago. That was way before Google invented the term. This was 30 years ago. And the idea was that you don't take hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. It's called letting go. Effort is trying to make things happen. So I thought renunciation, that was my latest. I throw it up in the air, see if it sticks. And then right mindfulness. And the last factor, which is always, and I can't imagine why that lasted even so many years. Instead of right concentration, right stillness. And if you have a spiritual sensitivity, you know that stillness is far more spiritual than concentration. Concentration is what sports people do. We're not sports people. We're spiritual people. And that stillness is something which is so important. So anyway, so with reference to this, it was said, the middle way discovered by the Buddha avoids both these extremes and leads to nirvana. Later on, we'll see how it doesn't just lead to these wonderful states of your own knowledge and understanding without vexation and suffering, but it also leads to non-conflict as well. No arguments, no fighting others or other people who disagree with you. Non-conflict, and soon see how this happens. Anyway, a pause for questions. Okay, maybe the questions come afterwards. Number two, one should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage. And to understand what those words mean, they're pretty well described underneath, and I will also add some meanings to them. Knowing this, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? And this makes it very clear where a lot of conflict comes from. How, bhikkhus, does there come to be extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma? When one says, all those engaged in the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to sensory desires are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they've entered upon the wrong way. One disparages some. The Buddha is also using what he already said to reinforce it. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to sensory desires and without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, they have entered upon the right way. Oh yeah, some of my editing didn't come out. Entered the right way. One thus extols some. When one says, all those engaged in the pursuit of asceticism are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they've entered upon the wrong way, one disparages some. When one says, all those disengaged from the pursuit of asceticism have entered upon the right way, and thus extols some. So, when one says, he had another little phrase here, all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way. One disparages some. When one says, all those who have abandoned the fetter of being are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and have entered upon the right way, one extols some. This is how there comes to be extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma. And how does there come to be neither extolling nor disparaging, but teaching only the Dhamma? When one does not say, all those engaged in the pursuit of pleasure have entered upon the wrong way, but says instead, that pursuit of pleasure linked to sensory desires is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. Then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say, all those disengaged from the pursuit of pleasure have entered upon the right way, but says instead, the disengagement of such a pursuit is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. It is depersonalizing these statements. You don't say just all these people who don't practice Dhamma the right way, all these people who don't practice Ajahn Brahm's method of meditation, it's a state beset by suffering. That is very conflicting. And that is not the right way. But instead you say the teachings, all those who don't follow the teachings of the Buddha, that is also conflicting. You say the non-practice of the teachings of the Buddha leads to suffering. You teach Dhamma, principles, rather than things which persons get offended by. So you say, all followers of Donald Trump are causing trouble in the world. That is not the right way to speak. But making it impersonal, saying things like the following of egocentric, unsubstantiating misinformation is a state which has vexation and suffering, doesn't lead to anything which is good, then that is teaching Dhamma. So whenever we teach, hopefully I'll try my best to do this, we never say about a person, we never say about a group of people, all Catholics are pedophiles. That's a terrible thing to say. And of course it's not true. But if you say that pedophilia is a bad thing, then that's teaching a Dhamma. It's teaching something which doesn't associate those actions or that speech with a person or a particular group of people or subsection of people. But you just say the thing in itself, the action itself, is bad. And that means that people don't get offended that easily, but they realize what is good and bad and helpful in this world. But it just further reinforces that. When one says all those engaged in the pursuit of asceticism are beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and they have entered upon the wrong way, one disparages some. And when one says all those disengaged from the pursuit of asceticism, painfully noble and beneficial, are without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, they've entered upon the right way, thus one extols some. When one... I've lost my place here, I have indeed. Okay. I should be going back to be neither extolling nor disparaging, but teaching only the Dhamma, so I've redone a paragraph there. So, I'm going to begin again on how there comes to be neither extolling nor disparaging by teaching only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those engaged in the pursuit of pleasure linked to sensual desires have entered the wrong way, but says instead that pursuit of pleasure linked to sensual desires is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, it is the wrong way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those disengaged from the pursuit of pleasure linked to sensual desires have entered upon the right way, but says instead the disengagement of such a pursuit is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the right way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those engaged in the pursuit of asceticism have entered upon the wrong way, but instead says the pursuit of asceticism is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those disengaged from the pursuit of asceticism have entered upon the right way, but says instead the disengagement is a state without suffering, and it is the right way, then one teaches only Dhamma. When one does not say all those who have not abandoned the fetter of being have entered upon the wrong way, but says instead as long as the fetter of being is unabandoned, being too is unabandoned, then one teaches only the Dhamma. When one does not say all those who have abandoned the fetter of being have entered upon the right way, but says instead when the fetter of being is abandoned, being is also abandoned, then one teaches only the Dhamma. So again, it's learning how not to associate any of these problems, attachments to a being, a person, a group of people, but just teaching just attachment to being here. This is one of the Sanyojanas is a set event is a wrong path, then it is much easier. A good example of that is one thing we always tend to discuss amongst the wider Sangha, is that sometimes that people talk about this idea of, say, an original mind. And there are some monks, including myself, who say that's not mentioned in the suttas at all. It's not mentioned by the Buddha. In fact, it's clearly stated that there is no such thing as an original mind. So I might say, all those who say there's an original mind have entered upon the wrong path, it's a state beset by suffering. Then there are some monks who get very upset at me. And if I say, all those people who realize there is no such thing as an original mind, and that is the right path, then it's praising some. It's again upsetting people who don't agree with that. But when you say instead, the idea that there is an original mind is not stated anywhere in the Buddha suttas, then it's not praising some, it's not disparaging some, it's saying something which you can check up by yourself. So it is a thing which doesn't lead to conflict. Do you understand that? Okay, so it was with reference to this that it was said one should know what it is to extol and what it is to disparage. And knowing both, one should neither extol nor disparage, but should teach only the Dhamma. Any questions about that? Yes, thank you. Could you use a microphone so, because this goes overseas? Yes, there's no such thing as a criminal. There's someone, it's a criminal act which someone has done, but they're much more than that. This also is it's about praising disparaging people. Instead of praising disparaging people, it's teaching the Dhamma, so you say it's a wrong thing to murder. It hurts to murder. It's a state beset by suffering, vexation, fever, worry, ill will, anger. But instead of just disparaging the murderers, disparage the act, the speech. And sometimes, even today, somebody told me about their boss was giving them a hard time. Were they? You're disparaging your boss. How about saying that a bad speech is unhelpful? That asking too much of the workers is not very good for the morale in the office. Saying that is like a statement which is no one can dispute. But if you say that you, Thomas, you just give me such a hard time and ask me to do this and ask me to do that, it's not, obviously. But, you know, you can get upset if you didn't know me. But this is one of the reasons why, to stop that conflict, we try to depersonalize it. Even the Buddha was saying that, even about Dhamma. You have some wonderful arguments, wonderful discussions, but if you say, all those people who just say that meditation is not necessary to become enlightened, that they are sharing wrong views. They should never do that. And of course, that's going to cause conflict in our communities. But instead, you just say that meditation is necessary for enlightenment. Jhanas are necessary. So, can you see the point the Buddha's making here? And if you're in any leadership position, you know, in a company, in an office, in a monastery, it's important to remember that. It's so easy to upset people. Okay, now, does that answer the question, sort of? Okay, thank you. Paragraph 3. One should know how to define pleasure, and knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. So it was said. With reference to what was this said? And of course, for anyone who went to Buddhist monasteries years and years and years ago, sometimes we weren't supposed to have any happiness. If you were smiling, I remember going to have my photograph taken when I was a young monk, and because of the tradition in the lay life, is smile when you had your photograph taken. They said, no, don't smile. You know, you're a monk, you're serious. Mm. And that was dishonest. And I will never forget this nun in Hong Kong. And after I went there the first time to teach a retreat, after the retreat was finished, before I left to come back to Australia, she told me, she said, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. For what? She said, before you came, I was not allowed to smile. Now, after you've come, I'm allowed to smile. A simple thing like that she thanked me for, because she was an elderly nun, and I thought, if you're smiling, it means you're not practicing, you're indulging in something. I said, no, this is part of becoming a good monk or a good nun. So anyway, you should pursue pleasure within oneself. So it was said, and with reference to what was just said. And they said, there are these five senses. What five? forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire, provocative of lust. These are the five senses. You all know the five senses. Now the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on these five senses are called sensual pleasure. A filthy pleasure, a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should not be pursued, that it should not be developed, that it should not be cultivated, and it should be feared. And the word filthy pleasure there, that was the translation which I think in Bhikkhu Bodhi's, but the Pali word there is milha, and it is a coarse word. It literally means, the best translation, please excuse me, it means piss, P-I-S-S. And the Buddha was using that word. And when I saw that, wow, that was very powerful. The Buddha was using a coarse word for that. And I say of that pleasure, it should not be cultivated, it should be feared. Alternatively, quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, one enters upon and abides in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. This is called the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, upasama, the bliss of enlightenment, sambodhi. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, and it should not be feared. And of course, when I read something like that for the first time, wow, that this is the Buddha extolling the pleasure and happiness, the bliss, which come from these deep meditations. But also, that these similes he said about this, the bliss of renunciation. The other pleasures are usually called the bliss of accumulation, of getting things, possessing things. This is a bliss of renouncing, giving up, letting go, and things really disappearing. The bliss of seclusion, which I love that because, yeah, I hang out with a lot of people, teach a lot. There's nothing like just being by oneself. Lockdown is my heaven. But bliss of peace, upasama, it comes up later on in another context in this sutta. And the bliss of enlightenment, sambodhi. When I read that, I thought there must be some error there because everybody knows that jhana is not enlightenment. But the Buddha gave it the description of the bliss of enlightenment. He said it's the bliss of enlightenment, what you feel in those jhanas. It's like the taste of freedom. It's what it's like to be enlightened. It's only temporary. So if you want to know what enlightenment is, or rather what it feels like, the Buddha said, get into a first jhana, or second, third, fourth jhana, and then you know what it feels like. It's a powerful statement. And that gave me the goosebumps when I first read that. And I say of this kind of pleasure, it should be pursued. It should be developed, it should be cultivated, and it should not be feared. And even in some traditions, people tell me that people teach you to be afraid of those deep meditations. Don't do that, don't do that, don't go there. I won't tell you which traditions they are because otherwise I'd be contradicting myself. I say teaching that jhanas is to be feared, that is not the Buddha's teachings. Now that's teaching Dhamma, rather than saying this group or that group. But of course, I don't do that. That is extolling instead of just teaching Dhamma. So it's with reference to this that it was said one should not know how to define pleasure. Knowing that, one should pursue pleasure within oneself. Questions? Yes, Bill.
What happened to the sixth tent, the mind?
That is it. That's the pleasure within. So that's that sixth sense. That is mentioned elsewhere. But the five senses, or the pleasures within, that's the sixth sense pleasure. Thank you, Bill. One should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt sharp speech. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? First of all, that difference. The covert is, I said, a secret speech. And the overt speech is something which is called samukha, which means in front of people. And it reminded me of, you know, for the monks, if there's any accusations against a monk, you cannot discuss that privately. It has to be done in their presence. It's, you know, it's even a word for it, samukha vinaya. I really like that. You can't sort of meet in secret and say, oh, that Ajahn Bhumali, oh. I mentioned his name only because I really respect him. He's a very good monk. He may be listening to this in quarantine. But anyhow, that speech, discussions have to be done with everyone present, especially those ones who you should discuss it with. And if they're not there, we cannot do anything. So, because sometimes people get the wrong opinions, the wrong ideas. Something is said, it was not said accurately or precisely. And sometimes, and I've seen this, you know what I think, and then it goes into speech, which is pretty accurate, and somewhere along the line, between it coming out of my mouth and going into your ears and into your brains, that something goes wrong and it's misinterpreted. Has that ever happened to you? I never said that. You said something close, but not exactly that. Or you minced your words. It was misinterpreted. So because of that, it's really good to have people right in front of you. And you can, a lot of the times you can tell by their body language whether you said the wrong thing. Which means you can say if you said the right thing. And thereby it's less opportunity for conflict. So, here this is the explanation with reference to what was this said. Here, monks, my goodness, this is. What does your one say there? Is your the same? Because I took out a lot of these. But it's now repetition. Yeah, it's still here. Okay. Here, we don't say monks. The reason I don't say just monks here, because you're not monks. These are teaching not just for monks, they're teaching for nuns as well. And one of the nuns, you know, who listens to this regularly, she said, I get a bit upset about this, because you mentioned bhikkhus, and there's no mention of bhikkhunis. It's almost like we don't exist. So of course you exist. And so I like to take off bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, anybody, and just have here when one knows covert speech to be untrue, so it's a general, not just to bhikkhus, to monks. So please excuse me for that. Here when one knows covert speech to be untrue, incorrect and unbeneficial, one should on no account utter it. When one knows covert speech to be true, correct and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. When one knows covert speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it knowing the time to do so. The important thing there is it's beneficial. So the three things, if it's untrue, incorrect, unbeneficial, shut up. If covert speech is true, correct, but doesn't help anybody, don't utter it. But one knows it's true, correct, and beneficial, one may utter it knowing the time to do so. And so if something is true, you know it's likely to upset somebody, you don't tell them it in public. Hey, you know what Venerable Vipassata did today? He's a very good monk, very good novice, sorry. But you never do it in public. It's very embarrassing, it doesn't really help at all. And also, you don't do it when somebody is not in the mood to hear it. They may have had a really busy day, they're so tired. You wait until they're in a good mood. That's why I often say in marriage counseling, if you need to tell your husband or your wife something, and you know, it's really so sensitive, take her out to dinner first of all. Expensive restaurant. The last course, you can ask them anything. You get the idea. The right time. Here, because when one knows overt sharp speech to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, again, one on no account should one utter it. When one knows overt speech to be true, correct, and unbeneficial, one should try not to utter it. But when one knows overt speech to be true, correct, and beneficial, when one may utter it, knowing the time to do so. So again, even though it's correct and true, if it's of no benefit to anybody, again, be quiet. But if it is of benefit, know the right time, and then you can utter it. Remember, this is about non-conflict. So it was with reference to this that it was said, one should not utter covert speech, and one should not utter overt sharp speech. 5. And of course, this is one I should always remember, because sometimes, I don't want to keep you here too long, and I have other things to do as well, so sometimes I do speak hurriedly. Please excuse me. One should speak unhurriedly. Sorry, that's my nature. Not hurriedly. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? Here, when one speaks hurriedly, one body grows tired and one's mind becomes excited. One's voice is strained and one's throat becomes hoarse. And the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is indistinct and hard to understand. When one speaks unhurriedly, one's body does not grow tired, nor does one's mind become excited. One's voice is not strained, nor does one's throat become hoarse, and the speech of one who speaks unhurriedly is distinct and easy to understand. So with reference to this, it was said one should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. And of course, in disputes, people do get excited and they do speak very fast. And I'm sure you've experienced that. One of the times I experienced that was not during a dispute, but when I attended the auction for the land of Dharmasara. And I've never been to an auction before, not an auction like that. And I remember the auctioneer started off slowly, but then his pace started to increase. He started more hurriedly. And now do I have 400,000, 425,000, 450,000, 475,000, 485,000, 485,000. I'm sure you've been to auctions before, but he went so fast that everyone just got excited. And I'm sure some people would bid sums which they couldn't afford, like Eddie Fernando. Our treasurer went bananas when he bid 650,000. His limit was 600,000. He bid 650. When we got him for 650, and bless him, and just he did a wonderful good act of karma. He trusted his heart, and of course that's where Dharmasara started from. Wonderful. So it was with reference to this that it was said one should speak unhurriedly, not hurriedly. Now we have number 6, the local language not override normal usage. One should not insist on local language and one should not override normal usage. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? How does there come to be insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage? Here in different localities, they call the same thing a dish, a bowl, a vessel. It's one thing they call a dish. In other places they call it a bowl. In other places they call it a vessel. Other places they call it a saucer, a pan, a pot, or a basin. So whatever They call it in such and such a locality, one speaks accordingly. Firmly adhering to that expression, insisting, only this is correct, anything else is wrong. This is how there comes to be insistence on local language and overriding normal usage. And how does there come to be non-insistence on local language and non-overriding of normal usage? Here in different localities, they call the same thing a dish or a basin. So whatever they call it in such and such a locality, without adhering to that expression, one speaks accordingly, thinking, these, it seems, are speaking with reference to this. This is how there comes to be non-insistence on local language and overriding of normal usage. In other words, one doesn't use the different expressions which people have for the same thing, or the different pronunciations. Even recently, a Bodhinyana monastery, I was saying to get some of the monks to, you know, to try and work a little bit more diligently, that I had, being the boss monk there, I had leverage. And other monks said, no, not leverage, leverage. What's the difference? Oh, you've got to pronounce it correctly. Yes, but where I came from, it was leverage. But then where they come from was leverage. How we get conflicts in silly places, which is not necessary. You remember that discussion we had? Yeah, it was crazy.
I think it's leverage.
No. A lever. You call it a lever. But anyway, who has leverage or leverage? I don't insist on it. So this is how we can avoid the sum of the conflicts in this world. Simple things. So they have a summary now. Here, going right to the very beginning. Here, the pursuit of the pleasure that is linked to sensual desires, low and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It is the wrong way. Therefore, it is a state with conflict. Sometimes you have to look a little bit deeper there. Pursuit of pleasure linked to sensual desires is beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. You don't always get fever and suffering. Sometimes you get a lot of happiness, but it doesn't last. That's where the conflict comes from. Conflict with yourself, you're hopeless, it's not working. Conflict with others who stand in the way of your sensual gratification. So you can see that is where, essentially, where conflict comes from. Seeking for pleasures. Hence, disengagement from the pursuit of the pleasure that is linked to sensual desires, low and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering. Vexation, despair, and fever. It is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. If you are really giving up your sensual pleasures, because you've got a better pleasure of the mind, then, of course, you don't have so much conflict in the world. That's one of the reasons why people like meditating monks should have far less conflict in the world. They don't create such conflict. They're not really concerned with that part of the world. The pursuit of asceticism, painfully noble and unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever, and it is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. And that it sort of explains that I know that some people would say to me that, you know, their partners go to these retreats, and afterwards they're more of a pain in the butt than they were before they went. Why? They're not pursuing sensory pleasures, but it is pursuing asceticism. I remember doing that myself sometimes on those early retreats, even here. You sit late at night, and I made a resolution, I'll be the last person to leave the meditation hall in the evening. That's my resolution. It was stupid, it was ascetic. But then, after about an hour, I'd open my eyes, about two people still sitting there. And I sit for another half an hour. There's another person that still hadn't left. Smart ass. I had a lot of conflict there. It's crazy. What am I doing that for? Well, I did it for a few times until I said, that's just stupid. So that's actually the pursuit of asceticism. Who can be the most ascetic? It's not the path. It's painfully noble and unbeneficial. It is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It's the wrong way. Therefore, it's a state with conflict. Disengagement from the pursuit of asceticism, painfully noble and unbeneficial, is a state without suffering, vexation, despair, and fever. It is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. So people, when they go on a retreat, they know just when to push a little bit, but they know when they're tired, they need to go and have a rest. You find those people are much easier to live with. When they go home, they're much more peaceful and much better partners than when they left. Is that true? I reckon it is. I wouldn't know because I don't have a partner, but I reckon it's true. Here, the middle way discovered by the Buddha avoids both these extremes. Giving vision, giving knowledge, it leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. It is a state without suffering. It is the right way. Therefore, this is a state without conflict. And of course it is, because it leads to these beautiful teachings, beautiful insights to a knowledge, peace, or giving vision. This is inner vision, the eye of the Dhamma, the chakku. Giving knowledge leads to peace, upasama again, to direct knowledge. This is not knowledge what you read in the books or you hear from monks like me. This is your own knowledge, what you see for yourself. And enlightenment. That's the sambodhi to nibbana. A state without suffering is the right way. Therefore, it's a state without conflict. What about conflict with other religions and paths? There's this beautiful teaching in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And somebody asked the Buddha, one of the last teachings of the Buddha, can people in other paths and religions become enlightened, or only Buddhists? Really nice question. And the Buddha said, beautiful answer, anywhere where there's the practice of the Eightfold Path, you'll find enlightened beings. It's not the name you call it. It's not when you think you're a Buddhist, Theravada Buddhist, Mahayana Buddhist, a Hahayana Buddhist, or whatever. It's what you're doing, how you're practicing. And that's a beautiful answer, gets to the heart of it. And it's not sort of creating conflict. The extolling and disparaging and failure to teach only the Dhamma is a state beset by suffering. It is the wrong way. Therefore, this is a state with conflict. I did mention quite at length about how it is upsets people. When people tell you, well, you're too lazy, to work in my office. How does that feel? It feels awful because you quit and you're still saying, that's not me. You don't say that as a boss, you say that laziness, is not really helpful for anybody. Or things like that. You don't add the person to it, otherwise the person takes that as an insult. And here, extolling and disparaging, fair teaching only the Dhamma is a state beset by suffering. It's the wrong way, a state with conflict. Not extolling, not disparaging, teaching only the Dhamma is a state without suffering. It is the right way, therefore it is a state without conflict. A good example of that, when the Buddha was tested, is this only Buddhists can become enlightened? That is, if he said yes or no, that would be disparaging or extolling. He said, no, practicing the Eightfold Path. So practicing the Eightfold Path will lead to nibbana, will lead to enlightenment. That doesn't praise some, disparage others. Because anyone can practice Eric Prabhupada. Of course you need right view in there, which means you're a Buddhist. But nevertheless, the way it was stated was something which was not extolling some and disparaging others. Here, sensual pleasure, a filthy pleasure, you know what that word is, I won't repeat it again, a coarse pleasure, an ignoble pleasure, is a state beset by suffering. It is the wrong way, therefore this is a state with conflict. Here, the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment, what the Buddha described earlier as the four jhanas, is a state without suffering. It is the right way of a state without conflict. And the other thing there is anybody who has gone into a deep meditation, you just can't have conflict. It just is not, the means for that is just not there. That's why that sometimes when somebody comes up to me, I'm telling all my tricks again. It's not my tricks, it's everybody's tricks. When somebody has a deep meditation, and I want to find out if it really is a deep meditation, and I tell people, people who are lawyers cannot attain jhanas. They can't. They haven't got enough good karma to do that. I try and say something just to upset them on purpose. I never say that to like a couple, somebody who came after the meditation yesterday. That was, Thai kickboxers. I'm always very polite to them. But you do that, but it's just to see if people get upset. And if they get upset, that's a much quicker way of saying, well, that couldn't have been a jhana you just had. You just can't get upset after a jhana. Yeah, okay, that's your view, that's fine by me. But if they say that, I said, oh, I'm sorry, but I think that really was a jhana. Yeah, I was only testing you. Because those blisses, you can't have conflict after those until that the afterglow of those deep meditations disappears. Covert speech that is untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering, therefore is a state with conflict. Covert speech that is true, correct, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering, therefore is a state with conflict. Covert speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without conflict. The same with overt speech, untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial is a state by suffering. Overt speech that is true, correct, and unbeneficial is a state beset by suffering. It's called a state with conflict. Overt speech that is true, correct, and beneficial is a state without suffering. Therefore, a state without conflict. Again, the Buddha is teaching us how to avoid conflict and settle conflict. So if it's covert speech, you just heard on the side, or speech right in front of you, whether it's, first of all, it has to be true. Find out if it's true. Find out if it's correct. Is it beneficial? And that's the thing we should always think about. Is it beneficial? And secondly, is it the right time and place? For the monks, they have extras there. They always say that if it's something which is true, correct, and beneficial, and it's the right time, say, but are you doing something similar yourself? It's the old story of take out your own faults before you try and find faults with others. And if you've still got some of those bad behavior or bad speech yourself, don't say anything to them until you've sorted out your own bad behavior. And I like that, and I tell the monks that. In other words, that they can't say anything because they still got some work to do. Here, the speech of one who speaks hurriedly is a state beset by suffering, vexation, despair, and fear. It is the wrong way. It's a state with conflict. The speech of one who speaks unhurriedly in a state without is a state without suffering. Therefore, it's a state without conflict. And of course, that's where people misunderstand what has been said. Or, you know, they just, it's something interesting, but I spoke it too fast, so they didn't get it. So that causes a lot of conflict in the human relationships. Insistence on local language, no overriding of normal usage, is a state beset by suffering. Non-insistence on local language, a non-overriding of normal usage, is a state without suffering. Vexation, despair, and fever, it is the right way. Therefore, there's a state without conflict. So we just want to communicate our ideas or our experiences with others. So use the language, which Buddha said in other places, use a local language. And please excuse me that sometimes I use the S-H-I-T word, but that actually communicates with a lot of people. And honestly, when I went to down in Albany, sort of last weekend, and the room which I stay in, which I've stayed in every time I've gone down there now, that somebody made a little sign for me in there. And they're doing it as a gift, and they said, you can use this anywhere you like. You know what the sign was? It's one of my favorite quotes. And the quote, I got criticized for this quote before, but it's a good one. No need to seek for revenge, because karma will get the bastards anyway. Now, some people get upset about that, but it's a very powerful. And the person who did it said this really helped him in his life. So he wanted to actually paint it on a little sign for me. He left in that room in Albany. So if any of you ever go to visit Venerable Muda in Albany, you can see that sign in there. So this is Australia. You should not insist on local usage, or you should speak just what the local people speak. It's true, isn't it? People remember that saying. Okay, therefore, monks, nuns, lay men, lay women, everybody, you should train yourself thus. We shall know the state with conflict, and we shall know the state without conflict. And knowing these, we shall enter upon the way without conflict. Now we have a line which is really weird. Now, Bhikkhu, Subhuti is a clansman who has entered upon the way without conflict. No mention of him before. And no really need to mention. No need to extol. So sometimes I think that sometimes, because it's right at the end of the sutta, sometimes that does give me a bit of doubt there. Was that added? But it doesn't really matter, added or not added, it has no meaning with the sutta. Anyway, that is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's the Aranavibhanga Sutta. And please, at the beginning, I was a bit confused because I was spent so much time on that computer editing it. And I don't know why it didn't come out. The save button wasn't working or something, I don't know. Anyway, so hopefully, every time I try to do a sutta, I try and make it easy for you to understand without distorting the meaning, to take away a lot of the repetition, which makes it harder to really get, but hopefully you manage to understand most of that. So, So now some of the questions, if you have some questions. Questions from the floor, first of all, those people are here because you made the effort to come here. Yes. Oh yeah, and thank you for going to the microphone, that's very helpful.
Saying is not to insist on the local language.
Not to insist on it, not to not insist on it.
And would it be okay to say then that is what is meant there is use the local language, but for pivotal terms like what you have been doing,
yes,
use that for samadhi, use the word samadhi and explain as you have been explaining.
Sometimes you can do that, yes, use samadhi, means? Yes. But it's also noticing that in any place, even in that time in India, that people would travel. And so there'd be many, many different terms, even in that Ganges Valley. And so there may be visitors. And if you insist on the local language, you have to speak like this. Then some visitors do not understand what you're saying. So, you know, you see what people understand, and then that's what you use. Just being practical, because otherwise, as I said, leverage or leverage, these are small terms, and we understand what it means, and that's the most important.
I think what was referred there is not that type of differences, yeah. I think. It's the more pivotal, more what is really, really the Dhamma part that is explained but used the same term.
Is indeed. That? And there's also another part to that, as you may have heard, that you know, the Sanskrit was almost like a holy language, and the old form of Sanskrit was much, in a sense, more logical. Pali was like a developed form of Sanskrit, and so it had a lot of abbreviations. The words coming together were shortened, just like in English, that we have fun, I think, learning that such things are when you say crikey. Have you heard the word crikey in English? You know what it means?
In here, from you.
Yeah, it means Christ kill me. It was a shortened form of that. That's true, look it up. Blimey. Have you heard the word blimey? It means blind me. So many of these words, they've been in places like UK for centuries, and the tendency is always to shorten those words to make them easier to say. And now they have their own meaning, and when we see where they come from, you know, it gets quite amusing. That's what it meant a long time ago, but now it means something quite differently.
And I think I just remembered that you said when that word fever came, you said it's not really fever. I think it's the parilaho is the part.
Yes, that's right, yes, yeah.
And I think it's the blood pressure going up.
Yeah.
I think more appropriately, I think that is what it is.
Indeed.
Isn't it?
Well, we even see, you know, sometimes that people say, I got really hot.
Hot.
And the
blood
temperature is the
up.
Same, but it's just the emotions get very hot.
Emotions, yeah.
Yes.
Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you a question when you talk about it has to be true, beneficial, and at the right place and time?
Yes.
I find it really hard to understand the concept of truth. And practical examples, if you're a judge, or you're a medical expert, or you're the boss of the company, and you're required to come up with a decision, whether it's true to the person receiving it, or true in the concept of being true or not is from different person's perspective.
Indeed, which is one of the reasons why we will never find absolute truth,
yeah,
in this that type of situation. One tries to get it as accurate and truthful as possible. And I do remember reading an article about the boss of Air New Zealand who would deliberately sort of go to work as a baggage handler, as a check-in counter, or as one of the attendants on the flight. I don't think he ever worked as a pilot, that would be dangerous. But he wanted to find out what was really going on. And you know what happens when you're a leader, you know, especially like a prime minister or a big leader of a corporation, you only hear just what, you know, people feel you want to hear.
Mm.
You know, with your inner circle, they protect you from seeing anything else in the world. So now how could like a Donald Trump really know what was going on? He could only hear what he was told by his advisors. And sometimes that, you know, is far from the truth. People get manipulated. That's why I was very inspired by someone like a boss of Air New Zealand. You know, he couldn't trust what he was told. So he actually went to work, you know, with the baggage handlers. He went to work with the people cooking the meals for Air New Zealand in order to find out what's really happening. I thought that was a brilliant way of coming to find the truth.
So the concept of being true doesn't mean that it has to satisfy the every single party involved,
no,
basically.
No. So you know what's going on, and then you find out what's beneficial for everybody.
And in turn, there was someone who could be sacrificed who may not like what you say.
Yeah, indeed.
But that's fine.
You've got to find out how they like what you say. That's why I told someone just earlier about the sandwich method. The sandwich method is something I heard because, you know, okay, I'm a senior monk, but when I went to conferences, I like sitting in the back and listening to other people speak. So I'm not just listening to me. And that was when this HR manager who was working for David Miliband when he was just a junior minister. And then she said the sandwich method, when you have to tell somebody off, they're not doing their job. The sandwich method is you praise them first of all. They're just really misbehaving. You praise them first of all. Because what happens is then their ears open. And just they start to listen. That's the bread, the top slice. And then you put in the filling. Bah, you know, you're late, you're just not being efficient, blah, blah, blah. And then once you've told them off, but you know, you're a really, really valued member of our company, a wonderful monk. We really don't want to lose you because you have always wonderful assets and good characters and stuff. And that's the lower part of the sandwich. You start off praising, then you hit them metaphorically, and then you praise them afterwards. It works.
Thank you.
Okay, another question from over there, and then we'll do it. Yes, please, come up. And thank you for locals, one's actually here asking the questions, because so often it's just people from overseas. I don't disparage people from overseas, but locals sometimes don't get a chance. Yes.
Oh, hi, Ashram. So maybe I want to add a comment on that last question before adding my own question.
Yeah.
I think the Buddha in his supreme wisdom did account for that variable truth, because he said if it's true, correct, but not beneficial, you should not say it anyways.
Yes, yeah. It's just not knowing if it's really true or not. Sometimes you get the wrong information.
Because this talk is about conflict, I was wondering, because there are things where sometimes you're with a person and even though you state the thing without extolling or disparaging, you use local language, you get criticized by people who become quite incensed, and then they may disparage you with things which you know are incorrect.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? I mean, I guess if it's you're away by yourself and it's not in your face, it's different. But if it's in your face and you're right there,
yeah,
and what they're saying is you know clearly incorrect, how yep. would you deal with that?
Yeah, so great example of that. I think some of you may have witnessed that when we first came to this place many years ago, and this hall didn't exist at the time. This was a car park, and we just had a main hall there. We managed to have our opening ceremony when we invited the governor, Sir Gordon Reed, and his wife. And we were so pleased that he accepted our invitation. We were very small at that time. Remember that, Lynn? Yeah, it was beautiful. But anyway, that Ajahn Chakro gave me the instructions to actually to organize the tents, the marquees and the chairs, and I did all of that. He said, you know, this is a big event for us, so don't worry about the costs. So I called up a hire firm, I think in Netherlands, next to Peppermint Grove, you know, which hired all these things out for these millionaires down there. And I asked them, look, we need the best. We've got the governor of Western Australia coming on Sunday. And then, and then when the truck arrived on a Friday afternoon, I was busy helping someone else, so they unloaded and put up the tent. And I couldn't believe just how filthy that tent was. It was covered with red dust. That's not really a problem, because you could get the hoses out and clean it. The same with the chairs, all dirty. We could clean them as well. Well, we had about 10 chairs for VIPs. And it was honest. I can't imagine how this happened. But those 8-10 chairs had legs, different lengths. Not one of them was stable. They wobbled. They were inviting the governor on a couple of days. So I immediately got onto the phone. Managed to catch that hire firm just as they were closing. And the only person left in the office was the manager. She was a woman. And I explained it to her, we've got the governor coming tomorrow. Can we have some other chairs? And she said, oh, there must have been a big mistake. I'll get it fixed for you. She put the phone down. I felt happy that more chairs were going to come. And it did come in about half an hour, 45 minutes. And the truck, you know, came round the corner into Nansen Way. I was waiting for it this time because I wanted to make sure it was correct. And as soon as it turned the corner, maybe about 10 meters past the corner, one of the men jumped out of the cab. And it was still traveling fast. I was surprised he didn't injure himself. And he came running up the road and screaming, "Where's the bloke in charge? I want to see the bloke in charge." Because what had happened, they'd all gone to the pub to start their weekend off. And the manager had come in, "Their boys, the Buddhists want some new chairs." And they were not happy with us at all. And of course, I was the bloke in charge. So I always remember this. What a great memories of my life here. I went up and said to him, I said it quietly, "I am the man in charge here." And he put his fist right in front of my nose like this. And his eyes were wide. And his breath, you could smell the alcohol in his breath. There's the most alcohol I'd breathed in ever since becoming a monk. And I could see the corner of my eye, you know, all of the supporters. There's a lot of people here because they're getting ready for the event. Not one of them came to help. I go, "Ooh, what's happening?" I was about to have my lights punched out, local language. But I just gave loving kindness and peace. I was not just upset or afraid or anything. And it was a beautiful example of what can happen when conflict could have very easily led to hospital or a court case calling the police. Had his hand right in front of me, just staring me down. And I just was very peaceful and waited. The next thing which happened, he couldn't do anything. The one thing I noticed with conflict, there's a certain procedures you have to follow, unwritten laws, and I wasn't following those laws. And eventually one of his friends, the truck had parked, he came over, we were staring at one another. And then he put his hand on this man's shoulder and said, "Come on, let's unload the chairs. Yeah, I'll help you." And so we unloaded those chairs together. Don't be afraid when there's conflict. Give lots of peace and loving kindness. And then you find no one can assault you.
In the sense, if they're incorrect, how much should you try to correct them?
Do not correct them yet.
Okay.
Because remember that other story, quack, quack?
I do.
Yeah. Is there a chicken or a duck? Most things are small things. You can correct that later on if you are correct.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay. Any other from the floor here? I'll do some of the questions from overseas. There's only four questions here, so hopefully it won't take too long. I was just thinking about how I should introduce Dhamma to people of other teachings without offending them. It's just little things like one of the early meditators. She was introducing meditation, this is about 30 years ago now, 35 years ago, to year sixes in Rolleystone Primary School. And she was a wonderful person. She used to go to the Armidale Meditation Group. And I might get the timing wrong, but she did not call it meditation. She called it quiet time. And for the year sixes, introduced it at the beginning, just 5 minutes, and built it up to about 15 minutes by the end of the year. And the kids loved it. This was in a way before mindfulness was encouraged in schools. And that few of the parents, they were devout Christians. It was a very strong Christian area in Rolling Stone. And so they complained to the principal. And so the principal defended her meditation to the hilt. She said, look, I've seen it myself. There's far less conflict in that class, in that year, than I've ever seen. And they gave examples. You know, these are boys and girls, you know, year sixes, you know, they're starting to get into puberty. And so there's a lot of stuff going on in their bloodstream. And so that sometimes there was an argument, somebody said something about somebody else and there's about to be a big argument. And then one boy or one girl will put their hand up, Miss, can we have quiet time now? And they just, okay, everybody quiet time. And they just sit down there peacefully for 5 or 10 minutes and that solved the problem. He said, I've never seen this before, but I really encourage this. So later on, he invited me to the school to give a talk. And it wasn't really to give a talk so much as to say thank you for teaching this woman who taught her kids. She taught like that year six or seven until she eventually retired. Other people weren't offended because their kids were getting good results and there was harmony in the classroom. I am new to meditation. Last meditation, just before Ajahn Brahm hit the gong, I was relaxed, but I noticed tears flowing involuntarily. Is this okay? Very okay. Lots of people have tears when they meditate. Sometimes it could be that your bottom is hurting very much. That's very unlikely. You're relaxed. It's usually tears of joy, tears of freedom. If any of you ever look at the suttas, you'll find that's a form of what they call pity. Now, it's P-I-T-I, it's a form of expression of joy and happiness. You're literally crying for joy. You're as relaxed, not just tears flowing, but great, let them come. And I also can't resist the story of this gentleman who on a retreat, 9-day retreat at Charna Grove, after 3 or 4 days, in his interview he said, something's going wrong, I'm just crying involuntarily. And my answer to him was, when was the last time you cried? And he was silent. And then he spoke and said, I was about 12 or 13, I think. And my father told me, Australian men don't cry. He hadn't cried since. And I said, yes, they do. He said, you got a lot of crying to catch up on. And he cried for the next 4 or 5 days. Lots of times in the Dhamma hall. He was a very popular young man afterwards. So if any of these men in this room here, they haven't got a partner yet, you cry on a meditation retreat, you'll have many offers. That's true. But anyway, there's nothing wrong with crying like that. If there's a reason for it, you're depressed, or you're very, someone's really offended you or something, they're disappointed, then that's something different. But the joy, or just the crying, the tears, when you can, why not? From the UK, here in the monastery, samadhi is not taught. Ooh. Instead, they emphasize sati awareness as a way to the deathless. Sometimes it's even equated to the deathless. It's in order to become enlightened, you do need to follow the Eightfold Path. It's not just mindfulness, it's also samadhi, the stillness. And the Buddha never taught a sevenfold path, an eightfold path. And even if you practice all the other factors properly, stillness happens, samadhi happens. You sit down there, and the mind becomes very still, beautiful lights come in the mind, a lot of joy, and you're very, very detached from the world. So, samadhi was taught by the Buddha. Why is it not taught in those monasteries? Sila, samadhi, panya, the threefold path. From Canada, do all types of sensory pleasures hinder progress towards inner pleasure? It's the pursuit of those inner pleasures. Sorry, got that wrong. It's the pursuit of sensory pleasure hinders your pursuit of that inner pleasure. You've only got a certain amount of time. So a lot of times if we're pursuing the sensory pleasures, what's on the movies tonight? You know, what food can you get tonight? Now you got Uber Eats, apparently. I found this out yesterday. And you can order whatever you want. Uber Eats will deliver to your door. I think fortunately Bodhinyana Monastery is too distant from anywhere, so they won't come there, thank goodness. But it's not the pursuit of sensory pleasure. The body has some sensory pleasure. It's natural to have sensory pleasure. It's natural to have sensory pain as well. But the inner happiness is far more reliable, far more peaceful, far more deep, and lasts much longer, has greater benefits. So that's why all types of sensory pleasure hinder progress towards inner peace. It's the pursuit of that. You know, really wanting it, demanding it, and finding out how you can increase those pleasures. Because that is asking from the world something it can't give you. Okay, that's 4:30 now. So that should be the end of the end of the session here. But is there any other questions which you have before going? Gone, okay. So we finish off now, and then we bow three times to the Buddha, because this is, you know, suttas, and I really respect those. So bow three times, and we do the Arahant Sammasambuddho chant. Then afterwards, if you have a question, please come up to ask it.